The Invisible Woman by Gwendolyn Howard. Behind the facade, I hid my soul. I feared what others would say, and I feared what I knew to be true. But I heard you singing in four-part harmony that everyone is beautiful. And I hoped that everyone included me. I wanted to join your song. I wanted to raise my voice with yours. That's when I discovered that everyone doesn't mean all. You told me to be silent. You told me to go back to the shadows. You told me to disappear again. You said it was for the best if my soul remained hidden. Do I have some hideous Medusan power to harden the order of creation into ugliness? That is what I heard you say. I believed you. I believed you for a time. But my soul's tears and its longing to live its own truth grew more powerful than any admonitions, than any fears. And I began to sing. A small voice at first, shaky and tentative. It was a small voice that would not stop. As my own music slowly crescendoed with confidence, my hymn soon rang out, "Enough, enough. I will step into the sunlight. I will sing myself. The song of my soul will be heard." Though I could never raise my voice in your chorus, you can join my choir of glorious harmonies. And as I have been freed, so might you find freedom also. Not an easy freedom, but it is born of pain and experience, of innocence and hope. It is a divine oratorio. Yet our time can only begin if you believe that I am just as beautiful as anyone, and that we are just as beautiful as each other.
Thank you for that reading, Eleanor.
The poem by Gwendolyn Howard speaks powerfully of a sense of exclusion that is felt by many in our society today. I think it's arguably the biggest problem that we have as a species, as human beings, is getting along with each other and not excluding one group or another group. We see that played out in politics as people try to define their base, their power base, and exclude those who aren't part of that base. There's no doubt that our society is becoming more diverse, and I'm an optimist. We're more diverse when it comes to racial differences and differences of sexual orientation. But we have a ways to go yet. This being Pride Week, I want to tell you a story from our own history, courtesy of Irene Barris Johnson. Irene is the wife of John Barris Johnson, who was the minister here for a number of years, and was in the Pride Parade with us yesterday, and are probably still speaking up. She wrote, "In September of 2004, the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia declared the prohibition on same-sex marriage to be unconstitutional. A few months later, our own minister, the Reverend Dr. John Barris Johnson, was on his way to Cape Breton's Sydney area on a Saturday morning to conduct a wedding of two women. So at this point, it had been declared unconstitutional by the province of Nova Scotia, but it still wasn't clear what the rules and regulations were going to be. But on the way, he had the radio on, and he heard that the federal government's Civil Marriage Act, Bill C-38, would receive royal assent on July 20th, 2005. John was able to incorporate this momentous news with the biggest and the most elegant wedding that he ever performed. And when the wedding guests broke out in cheers and applause, no one was surprised. But when the government... There's John right now.
John, we don't like you.
But when, When the government of Canada passed the marriage equality legislation, that was only one step in a long journey towards wholeness. Like the elusive pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, the loving, inclusive world that we strive toward seems to recede from our grasp as we approach it. Every year, our congregation has a leadership retreat in August. Be sure to put that on your calendar for this year. It's Saturday, August the 24th, and it's at a beautiful location down by the water at the Atlantic School of Theology. It's a time when we get together and think about who we are and where we're going and what the important things are for the congregation. At that retreat, as we were planning for it, I got thinking about the future of Unitarian Universalism, and I asked myself the question, what would it mean to remain on the cutting edge as a religious movement? See, that's been the history of our faith tradition. We have been on the cutting edge. We were among the first Christian denominations to question the idea of hell, that a loving God would condemn anyone to hell for eternity. That's a generally accepted question now, but at the time of Calvinism, it was heretical. We also questioned the idea of the divinity of Jesus, another very heretical idea. We were at the forefront of the struggle to end slavery, to promote women's rights, including the right to vote, and the right to have abortion procedures, and the rights for progressive sex education for all ages, and same-sex weddings, and just recently the right to medical assistance in dying. I lived through much of this history of progressive change in relation to the LGBTQ community, but living through it is not the same as being part of it. I listened recently to a challenging program on CBC Radio called Uncovering the Village. It centered around the recent serial killings of gay men in Toronto, but it began with an overview of the history of the treatment of gays in Canada. The turning point was arguably the bathhouse raids in Toronto in 1981. And I listened to that history, that amazing history, that revolutionary history, and I had to stop and reflect on what I was doing then. Had I slept through the revolution? I was a young engineer and a husband. I was focused on career and family, and I was largely oblivious to the great cultural changes that were going on around me. Reflecting on that time, it makes me wonder what changes are underway today that I may not be fully engaged with. So I'm just back from attending the annual General Assembly of our sister organization, the Unitarian Universalist Association of the United States. And I can tell you, no one in the UUA, no one in the American organization, is asking what it would mean to be on the cutting edge of a religious movement. In the spring of 2017, the UUA erupted, literally, in a series of protests and resignations related to the hiring practices and the treatment of people of color within the movement. There were two flashpoints, actually. The first was a questionable process used in hiring a white male for a relatively low-level position. But it was a hiring that bypassed qualified people of color. It was really a flawed process. This, what normally would have been smoothed over in the past and would have been said, oh, we'll do better next time and we'll take care of this. And what can we do to resolve the problem? Not this time. People were angry. This ultimately led to the resignation of the president of the UUA, Peter Morales, a very good man, a very good leader. But he just felt maybe he wasn't the right person to be leading us at that time. And he's Hispanic. That was followed by a contentious decision to fund a movement within the UUA. And that sprang out of the Black Lives Matter protests in the U.S., and the president of the UU Ministers Association, another man that I respect greatly, Don Southworth, wrote a letter kind of questioning whether we could afford to do what we were committing to do and whether the process had been right in approving the money and so on. Again, there was a real backlash. people were tired of hearing, we don't have the money, we're not making the commitment right now, we need to study this a little bit longer. And so the president of the UU, of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association, of which I'm a member, it's a continent-wide organization, he resigned. Great loss to the Ministers Association, because he was a very competent leader. But again, maybe not the right leader for the times. Within a matter of months, both the UUA and the UUMA, the association overall and the Ministers Association, they were operating with transitional leadership and a commitment to end the centering of white privilege within our movement. It's been praised as the spring of our enlightenment and called the Great Turning for Unitarian Universalists. And UUA has created a commission on institutional change, and the work underway has opened the way to include all of those within our organization who feel marginalized, whether that's for racial, economic reasons, matters of gender, or sexual orientation. It was literally thrilling to see the level of passion and energy that's going on in what can only be called a revolution within the UUA and the UUMA. Thrilling, a little bit scary. Because one of the things that's coming out of this is that we have a traditional way of doing things within our faith tradition that comes from our European background, a very healthy respect for authority, an avoidance of conflict, a way of sort of papering things over. If things are not good, we don't necessarily expose what really needs to be exposed, and we find a way of trying to keep everybody happy. Well, in effect, we don't keep everybody happy. A lot of people leave the organization because they just get totally frustrated. One like small example of that that's changing the way we do things, and it's revolutionary and it's difficult for some people to grasp, but meetings within our association are usually run by Robert's Rules of Orders. Roberts being, I'm not even sure the first name, but he was British, I presume, because they're a very strict set of rules of order. And if you're conducting a meeting and you know Roberts' Rules of Order, you can shut people down fairly easily. You know, I'm sorry, you're not speaking to the motion, you're speaking to the amendment to the motion, which we have to vote on before you can speak. So please sit down. Have you been in meetings like that? So what that does to somebody who doesn't give a hoot about Robert's Rules of Order is turn them off completely. So what they're trying to do now in our meetings is be a little more flexible. Bend the rules a little bit. If someone has something important to say, allow them to say it. Let people listen. If the meeting takes a little bit longer, so be it. But let's hear each other out. It was exciting to attend services at General Assembly. There were hard-hitting sermons that didn't pull punches, sermons that made me feel uncomfortable. There were varying degrees of preaching style, which I love to see. Like, there were really desk-thumping preachers, and there were very intellectual preachers, and there was everything in between. And there was a wonderful mix and fusion of music, great variety of music. So some of us get the UUA magazine, UU World, and people here need to remind me, I put it on my list of things to do. I want to get a dozen copies or so of that delivered to the congregation here. It's just very good background reading, although it's the American Association, not the Canadian Association. But in the spring edition of that magazine, which is ironically called UU World, there's an article written by a cisgendered individual about how difficult they found it adapting to the new norms of transgender and fluid individuals, getting the pronouns right, making sure they weren't offending people. I read the article, and I didn't see much to object to. But boy, a lot of other people did. And the problem was that this article had been written about issues that are really important to transgendered people by a cisgendered person, and it was all about how difficult it was for a cisgendered person to deal with these situations. So the editor apologized profusely, and they changed some of their procedures to make sure when they're doing a cutting-edge article, that they consult with people who are most affected by the article. And they published a series of responses to the article. And I want to quote here from one of those responses by Alex Capitan. Z, that's Z-E, his preferred pronoun. Z's preferred pronoun. Is a lay community minister, an organizer, an educator, and an editor. And as you read this, think about that story that the song that we sang, about the song that was never sung to us. He wrote, "My parents found Unitarian Universalism in 1991 when I was six. My dad was the son and the grandson of Presbyterian ministers, and my mom was raised a devout atheist in a small town in Wisconsin. The family joke was that when we joined the UU Church, my dad's family said, 'Oh no, he's lost religion.' And my mother's family said, 'Oh no, she's found religion.'" See, as a UU, I was raised to ask questions. I was raised to question everything. Everything that was presented by society as normal in my life. The segregation and racism of my hometown, the idea that adults knew more than children and youth, the expectation that I was a girl who would grow up to be straight. My gender is a story of many truths. Although the word genderqueer was originally coined in the 1990s, I certainly didn't have access to it or to any non-binary role models in the wider world. I had no language to describe who I was, so I simply was. I chafed at every expectation the world had for me based on my perceived gender. I knew what wasn't true, so I made choices, one by one, that brought me closer to ease, closer to myself. There are many truths about the word queer. Queer can mean strange. Queer can be a slur. Queer can be a self-identity term in terms of sexuality or gender. Queer can be an umbrella term for non-straight sexualities. Queer can be a political framework. It can even be an academic discipline. Queer theory was born in the early 1990s as part of queer activism, which pushed back against the growing segment of privileged gay and lesbian people, arguing that they were just as normal as straight people. Queer activism rejects the idea that normal is worth striving for, and it aims to tear down or transform oppressive social systems and structures, and this caught my attention. And it aims to tear down and transform oppressive social systems and structures like marriage, rather than trying just to extend that benefit to a few more people. Queer theory is rooted in post-structuralism, which teaches that there is no such thing as single, universal, absolute truth. And there are always multiple, even contradictory, equally true interpretations and meanings of something. Queer theory also questions everything that is presented as truth based on social norms, like gender binary. It upends and rejects those norms. Queer theory does not put stock in a static and immutable truth about who a person is based on the idea that they were born that way, that their gender or sexuality or race or any number of other things about them was hardwired in them. Instead, it emphasizes the choices we make. It's first and foremost about what we do and how we experience the world, not who we are or how we identify. And he concludes saying, this sounds a whole lot like Unitarian Universalism to me. And here ends the quote. So I'd like to end this morning with a story. Once upon a time, there was a village. A fairly large village, a very happy village. A lot of people loved being in the village. And they had one thing that everyone in the village prized, and it was a very large gemstone, a perfectly beautiful gemstone. And they kept it in the center of the village where everyone could see it. And when people came to visit the village, they would always take them and show them this beautiful gemstone that had been passed down from generations before. And one day a stranger came into town. It was a minstrel. We didn't get minstrels very often in town, and people were a little bit unsure of who this person was. He wanted to see the gemstone that he had heard about. And he went up, and he spent quite a bit of time just looking and admiring this beautiful gemstone. And then he called someone over, and he said, "Did you ever notice there's a crack in that gemstone? What a significant crack." And the people were amazed and surprised and a little bit frightened that their beautiful gemstone had this flaw in it. What were they to do? Well, as fate would have it, the minstrel said he knew someone who could fix this gemstone. So he said, "You give me that gemstone, and I'll take it away, because I know someone that can repair this for you." Can you imagine how much faith and trust and willingness it would take for the community to say, "Okay, take it away and bring it back when it's fixed"? But that's what they did. And for 3 years, they didn't hear anything. And then, to everyone's great relief, over the horizon came the minstrel, and he had the gemstone, and he brought it back. And he held it up for people to look at. And where there had been a crack in this gemstone, the person working on it had carved the most beautiful flower, using the crack as the stem of the flower and adding leaves and petals, and it was just the most gorgeous flower you can imagine, and it was engraved right into this gemstone. They had transformed that gemstone into something more beautiful than it had ever been before, to everyone's surprise and everyone's delight. You know, it's said that some members of that town had seen that crack in the gemstone all along, but they were afraid to mention it to anyone. They didn't want to challenge the prevailing belief of the perfection of the gemstone that the congregation or that the community had. So I'll leave you with that story this morning. There's a message there for us.